This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, literary agent Francis Golden just returned from a visit with Lynn Stewart in Texas.
4 days at a federal hospital prison outside of Fort Worth. Francis tells us how Lynn is doing and what we can do to help her.
We'll talk with Teresa Schoetz, daughter of political prisoner Russell Maroon Schoetz.
He was in a Maximax prison for over 20 years, no contact visits with his family, including his daughter. Now he's been released from the Maximax, about to go into the general population. He's issued a new book, Maroon the Implacable, and his daughter Teresa is on tour, presently in Texas, promoting her dad's cause and his new book.
They're the socially invisible, the families and loved ones of prisoners of a perpetual war on terror.
Victoria Britton is not only an extraordinary reporter and commentator, but a deeply sensitive, beautiful writer who's shown us the stupidity and cruelty which is a consequence of what they call the war on terror.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Longtime literary agent Frances Golden has for years visited inmates on death row. She's just returned from visiting Lynn Stewart in Carswell Medical Facility in Texas and joins us for a few minutes to talk about the visit. Welcome, Frances, to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be here.
And we're so glad to have you on because you just returned from a visit with Lynn Stewart in Texas, where she's at Carswell Medical Facility. And we wanted to first start by asking you about Lynn's spirits. How was she?
Well, when she caught sight of her beloved husband, Ralph Poynter, and this very old friend of hers, Fran Golden, she was in very high spirits. And she remained that way. We were there for 4 days, and most of the time we were in the prison with her. So it was a wonderful time for her to have people she loved around her.
And was this a contact visit, Frances? Were you allowed to touch each other?
Yes, but if we kissed more than once or hugged more than once, she would be fined. They would take away some of her privileges. It can only happen when you come in and when you leave.
So they're monitoring you for kisses and hugs during the visit.
Right.
So let me get this straight. We have an 88-year-old lady, you.
89. Don't take
away. I thought you were 89 next month.
In June. Yeah, well, I'm jumping the gun.
You're pushing 89. And we have a cancer-ridden woman in her 60s. And if you happen to give her a peck on the cheek in the course of your interview, they fine her. Yeah,
right. Well,
that really says it all about the American prison system.
Yes, that's how they become correctional, by denying intimacy and loving and hugging and kissing.
Yeah. So tell us some more. So you're there with Ralph. You're sitting around some table in a stark room. And what are you talking about with Lynn?
We didn't have enough time to talk. We were only there for about 70 hours, but we didn't have enough time. It was wonderful. We were there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. The day we left, all the plans were changed. No more 4-day visits, only Saturday and Sunday. They were heartbroken. The inmates were heartbroken because people come from all over the country to visit their loved ones. They have to pay a lot of money, and so they're very happy to spend 4 days. No more. From now on, only Saturday and Sunday.
Wait, Frances, did they announce this during your visit?
They didn't announce it, but the inmates were told during the visit that this is the very last time there will be 4 days available.
And this is visits to people who are not only incarcerated in one of the corners of America, but they're very ill. They're in a prison hospital.
Absolutely.
What is the new visit length going to be? What's the longest someone can visit for?
I'm not sure. I know we had from 5 till 8 or from 11 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. We had very long visits, and they were like shots in the arm to the prisoners. It's gone. It's all gone. And we said, why are you doing that? And they said, we don't have money for the guards to bring the people in and out and check on them and stuff. So we're cutting it down to 2 days.
Well, I'm sure that's a result of the Prison Industrial Complex Corrections Association of America wanting to increase their profits at the expense of inmates.
Tremendous blow. I'm so glad that I got in on this four-day visit. I can't tell you how lucky I am to have been there.
Lynn Stewart is in prison serving a 10-year sentence. The original sentence wasn't long enough, and the government appealed it and got the judge, pressured him to add on. It went from 28 months to 10 years. And this is all for...
If it had been the original sentence, she'd be out by
now.
Yeah,
right. She'd been over
That's
3
correct.
Years. And this is all for essentially vigorously representing a client and issuing a press release about his opinion on a ceasefire in Egypt. This is why she's in prison
Which
for this.
Which has no damaging results.
No, none.
Exactly.
None. Tell us about her health. I understand that her cancer came back and spread. What did she say about how she's feeling?
Well, we were very lucky because she was weeks away from her last heavy chemotherapy. So that night, when she gets the chemo, she's out. She is so weak, she can barely lift her hand. She's in pain. But when we were there, she was weeks away from her last chemo. Her cheeks were pink. She looked wonderful. She had energy. She had lunches, but which we took out of the commissary pack, you know, on the wall that where you put in money and you get food. We were there for so many hours. We always bought her lunch. But she was in high spirits. We were just so happy to be with her. She was in great shape. And I'm so glad. Do not go visit her when she's getting chemo because she's a basket case.
Listeners may not be aware, but Lynn was actually, it was advised that she have uterine surgery. And I understand that the doctors there waited about a year and a half before giving her the surgery.
That's true.
So that the doctor said it was the worst case he'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
How
right.
is the state of her checkups on all of her medical issues? Because she has several conditions.
Well, it's not good because the breast cancer has moved to her lungs. Her cancer is now in her lungs. That woman should not be in prison.
Well, let's talk about that because there's a provision in the law that allows the head of the Bureau of Prisons, if the government makes a motion and the judge grants it, the Bureau of Prisons can release her in a compassionate release so she can go back to her family in her home city.
Yes, but they've got to say that she's going to be dead within 3 months, and nobody can say that. It's just stupid. And the reason that she has it in her lungs is because they didn't treat her when they should have.
Exactly. I understand that the doctors have given her prognosis of anywhere between a year to 3 years survival if she stays in these conditions. If she were moved back to New York where she could go to Sloan Kettering and see the physicians who are here and who have been treating her before she was incarcerated, likely that would lengthen that, I assume. And I understand that she would have a place to stay with her son and wonderful, loving friends and relatives. Francis, you know, there's a strong people's movement that's been contacting the director of corrections. And
we spend a lot of time while we were there talking about that and building up that. It's just tremendously important for people to go to lynnstewart.org and sign on for this release, compassionate release. And then when you sign on, email every one of the people on your list, whether it's 10 or 500, and have them do the same. Because Ed Asner has signed on, Desmond Tutu has signed on. I understand that Nelson Mandela is about to. We're getting Jimmy Carter to sign on. It's really important that we send a million signatures to the powers that be to have her released.
That's Lynn Stewart, L-Y-N-N-E, lynnstewart.org. And I'll give you another address, and that's to the head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Right.
The man's name is Charles A. Samuels, Jr., the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He's at 320 First Street Northwest. 320 First Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20534. And keep, if you don't have a pencil, I'm going to repeat this at the end of the interview.
Oh, please,
so we'll give
that's
it to you
so
again.
Important.
Francis, I wanted to ask if you had a chance to talk to Lynn about Russell Maroon Schultz's transfer from SCI Green to SCI Mahanoy.
We didn't discuss it. She knew about it, and I told her it will change his life because I know what happened when Mumia went from death row to General Pop. But I tell you, I visited Maroon for 27 years. Every 3 months, I was there for two whole days, all day Saturday and all day Sunday. I saw four prisoners. One was Mumia and one was Russell. And that man was the smartest, brightest, most analytical guy I have ever met. And he and Mumia never saw each other or were not able to contact each other. But 3 days before Mumia was moved to Mahanoy, he was put in the same pod with Russell. And Mumia said, those 3 days with Russell were worth 27 years. He said that they never stopped talking, that the guy was so brilliant, that it was so marvelous to be together. So if he gets into General Pop, they're doing the same thing to him in Mahanoy that they did with Mumia. They took months to get him out of that. You know, they're investigating to see whether he can go in with General Pop. So he's there, but he's not in General Pop yet. They're just doing the same thing. They're just being typically disgusting.
It's going to be quite a day when they reunite there together and continue their conversation.
Will it ever?
It will.
The stories that I can tell you about Mumia writing to me and saying, you know, I can't understand these guys. He said, I know this sounds sappy, but they're so sweet. And I wrote back and I said, you have a pretty good command of the English language. How about telling me what you mean by it saying they're sweet? It's going to be wonderful for him to be at in general population. It'll give him a great lift.
Well, Francis, did Lynn have any words for her many supporters around the globe?
Yes, she said she tells everybody to get online and demand her release and to keep fighting and to be strong. As she said, we can do it. We can do whatever we want to do if we don't stop fighting. Don't stop fighting.
So go to lynnstewart.org, sign that petition, and write a letter to Charles Samuels Jr., Federal Bureau of Prisons, 320 First Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20534.
Francis, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've had a very intense week, and we appreciate your report.
I'm honored to have been able to be with her, and that is one incredible comrade.
Francis Golden, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
The pleasure is mine.
Hugs.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back Teresa Schultz, daughter of political prisoner Russell Maroon Schultz, who has spent 39 years in the U.S. prison system. As many listeners may recall, Russell Schultz has been held under intense lockdown, spending no more than 1 hour a day outside of his cell for the past 21 of those years. He was locked up in 1972 for his activity as a member of the Black Liberation Army. We caught up with Teresa Schultz in Texas, on tour promoting Maroon the Implacable. It's the first published collection of Maroon's written works analyzing the prison system, imperialism, and the drug war. More recent essays examine current political movements such as ecofeminism and matriarchy. Teresa Schultz, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And thanks for calling in from Texas. I know you're in the middle of an event, so we appreciate your joining us. We wanted to basically focus on two areas during our quick chat, and one is your response to the really momentous news that your father was transferred finally out of SCI Green to SCI Mahanoy. What did that feel like for you as a family?
Well, Well, actually, Heidi, it was interesting to think that Maroon had been told that he would die at SCI Green. And we had been, for years, fighting to transport him to closer to home where his family members could really visit him on a regular basis. But you know, Heidi, even when you went on levels like this transfer, it still doesn't bring this issue to home. For me, him to be free from solitary, from prison in general, would be when I would say we have won. I think there, Candy, the Secretary of Prisons and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, realized that there is a major campaign supporting Maroon. They had to do something to pacify the movement, the family members, and something like bringing him to where he's presently at SCI Mount Hanoi, which is 2 hours from Philadelphia. Yeah, that's great in the sense of family members being able to see him more often, but in reality, we want him home.
It will be easier for people to visit Maroon at SCI Mount Hanoi because it's a lot closer to Philadelphia than SCI Green was. His friends and supporters in New York can drive 2.5 hours. Don't you think that in and of itself will sort of help raise attention when people go back from visits and write about it, that can help bolster what I hope is the growing movement to free your father?
Yes, Heidi, it's a strategy that Maroon can take full advantage of with more visitors, and especially hopefully younger folks who will be able to visit him, as you said, New York and Philadelphia. And yes, they can go back to our communities and broadcast whatever message Maroon has sent through them. Yeah, it does make a difference. I'm not shooting it down. Yes, we want Maroon in the population, and this will help. But the ultimate goal is to free him from prison.
Before we talk about the wonderful book that has just come out, are you able to share with us any of the legal strategies that your, I know you have a multi-pronged legal team.
I can tell you this. I've been placed on a tour in which you couldn't ask me in our last interview, did I think or did I foresee this book being released and you with me on this present day tour? I didn't see it, Heidi. As far as the legal team and their strategy, we've been fortunate enough to have Brett Grote as an assistant to the legal team, Dan Kovalik, and we just got a major commitment from a huge law firm. I would prefer that we just leave that off the table because I don't want to leave folks in a direction that's not the proper legal terms or what the legal team has addressed already.
Of course.
I do know that the legal team has presented in writing a letter to Secretary Wetzel, the Secretary of Pennsylvania Prison, asking, well, I would say demanding, that Maroon is released into solitary confinement. If not, there will be legal action taken against the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania.
I think you meant to say released into general pop. Yeah, from solitary. Yeah, and we hope that will happen. Let's talk about the book. It's. I'm looking at it right now. Michael and I are looking at it. It's not only a book of deep substance, beautifully written, but it's a beautiful looking book. And there's a great portrait of your father on the cover. It's been edited by Fred Ho and Quincy Saul. And it covers really a range of topics. Again, it's so beautifully written. I wish everyone would just go out and get a copy now.
And it's easy to read.
Right.
And the great part about it is that Maroon has been writing since the 80s. And in the 90s, some anarchists around the country took his writings and put them in little Zine pamphlets, just took them from throughout the United States into Canada, and they were used as education pieces. and just sold at little inexpensive rates. But more than anything, so you get this span from Maroon's darts from the 80s to the present day, where he has introduced his darts on eco-socialism and women and matriarchy, and his view now on women are so incredible, because when you think of Maroon, you think of this Black Panther, some folks do, or this BLA member, Black Liberation Army member, and Maroon has stressed to me that he realized how important women are, how important they were in the movement throughout the 60s and the 70s, where during those times in the 60s and the 70s, he didn't really recognize how important the women were in the Panthers and in other movements. The women, you know, I would say are really the backbone of any community, any movement. And he now realizes that, and I'm so glad that he's got it and he writes about it in his book.
We're speaking with Teresa Schoetz, the daughter of Russell Maroon Schoetz, who's just had his book, Maroon the Implacable, published by PM Press. And I wanted to ask you, Teresa, give me the significance of the title. I suppose some people don't know what maroon means, and why the implacable?
He chose maroon because maroon has liberated himself twice throughout his stay in Pennsylvania prison systems, and he was captured. And on his return of the last escape, when he was brought back to the prison, another inmate mentioned to him, Maroon, they had a hell of a manhunt on you. You were chased down like a maroon. And he said, what are you talking about? Here's Maroon, who's so educated and educate so many other youth that are coming into prison. He didn't know anything about the Maroons, so he dug in deep about their history and how they came about. And the Maroons were slaves who had escaped from plantations, and some went deep into the woods or joined in with Native Americans, and some poor whites who were totally against this slave thing. They set up their own communities. I mean, if you look at it today, they were, as we say today, off the grid. They grew their own foods, and they survived. They also, and this is big, they also put up major attacks against slave owners who would try to come in and invade their new community, these maroon communities. And I mean, they fought off numerous attacks, never being taken again once they freed themselves, were a part of these maroon communities.
Teresa, he has a wonderful chapter called I Am Maroon that was written in 1995. I just want to read one sentence from it. It says, as I gradually began to learn about the Maroons, I became inspired by these audacious fighters, and the nickname Maroon became a badge of pride and a constant source of spiritual inspiration. It's a lovely chapter. It's short. And just like all the other chapters there, you can sort of take them on their own, read them one, you know, during a day, derive a little inspiration yourself from them. What a treasure. You must be so proud of your father.
And I am, because his digging deep for the history of the Maroons, he also involved me and my siblings and all. He said, you got to learn about these people because they were so awesome in fighting off attacks, and this was throughout the Caribbean areas, even into Mexico, where slaves had escaped. And you really don't find a lot of it in our history, especially, of course, not these public schools or their history books. So it was a welcome knowledge of the Maroons that he brought into our family members now, and we've been teaching it. I've been teaching it to the youth who I work with in my community.
Could you speak briefly on the implacable and why that's in the title?
Well, Maroon has endured such torture and just outrageous treatment with the 20-plus years of no-contact visits with his families, with 23-hour lockdowns, which comes under these control units. And not only is he housed in a control unit, the impact of this really does control mindset. And for a lot of the prisoners, they lose their mind. So The Implacable was the title for him. He said some folks thought that it wouldn't reach the young folks, that they wouldn't understand this title. And Maroon pressed forward. You know, with writing this book, Maroon doesn't have computers or anything like that, nor has he ever seen one up close and personal, but he does everything longhand, and it's through snail mail. And he fought back and forth through these snail mail messages stating, it must be the Implacable. I've withstood everything that they have thrown at me. So we all finally agreed. And so what we try to do is really educate folks on who Maroon is and why he chose that title.
I think it's a beautiful title. In speaking of education, just briefly, we have a few more minutes. Tell us what it's like being on the book tour. What do young people ask you about your father and the book?
It's incredible, because right now I'm at the University of Texas. I'm presently with the dean here and a professor in a writing class. I stepped out to do this interview, and they, of course, they understand, but to give them the history of Maroon and his writing style, and how was he able to keep up this type of writing for modern day folks and writers like what I'm presenting today. We've been well accepted. Some people have never heard of Russell Maroon shows, so that's always interesting, because if they haven't heard of him, they want to know more. You know, so we've been giving them everything. Of course, I'm on this tour with Quincy Soule, who has him, along with Fred Ho, edited the book. So this is an incredible team, him and I, and he really digs deep into the book since he's the editor, and we've just been well accepted. People want to know today about the present-day prison system.
And who better to tell them?
Who better than you? You know, never, I think of the hip-hop movement. It was an up and an uproar movement, but it was on a educational level. There were artists who were battling against each other, but through their voice, through their art, through dance. And it was squashed. It was squashed. So when there is an uprising of knowledgeable youth, sometimes the forces above don't want this to happen. And what's better than any youth movement? We have to step over what this government has thrown at us. They have more of a hand on our youth than some of these youth-owned parents. So everything is candy-coated. It's a reality form and television. And when you can get through, punch right through that wall of this candy-coated reality system that our youth are mixed up in, oh my God, it's not only uplifting for me, but for them, because these youth haven't heard it put to them this way. So, you know, they're just like little 1 and 2 year olds. You know, every kid comes into this world wanting to learn. Their little brains are like little sponges, and they want to suck up stuff. So when you get these college students some knowledge that they didn't know about, not aware of political prisoners, not aware of people who stood up in their communities and stood on the front lines to protect their communities against injustice, they like, wow, you know, we're being thanked on many levels for bringing this knowledge to these students.
Wow, Teresa, you are an amazing inspiration and teacher, and you better get back into that classroom.
Well, and thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Teresa.
All right, great. Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck to you and your dad.
We'll see you soon.
And one last reminder, Maroon, The Implacable, a collection of writings by Russell Maroon Schultz.
Free Maroon.
Free Maroon.
All right.
Take care. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links. links to many of the issues we discuss.
Chomsky says this about Victoria Britton's new book, Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. We should all have some sense of the horrifying events of which Guantanamo is a symbol. Here, Britton adds another crucial dimension to the shameful record with a searching, sensitive, and wrenching account of the ordeal of the women left behind, their torment, their endurance, and their courage, their triumphs over the cruel extension of prison to home, and not least, a revealing picture of what we have allowed ourselves to become. Victoria Britton has lived and worked as a journalist in Washington, Nairobi, Saigon, and London. She worked for 20 years at The Guardian, and she's the author of Death of Dignity, Angola's Civil War, and Enemy Combatant. She joins us today to talk about her new book, Shadow Lives. Victoria, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You've written really an extraordinary book, Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. Victoria, how did you get involved with these women and their children? Why did you feel like you wanted to tell their stories?
Well, I got involved way back at the beginning of when people began to be disappearing into Guantanamo Bay and were being described as the worst of the worst by Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush. Some of those people came from Britain, and we didn't know anything about them. And a friend of mine had a project to do a verbatim play about the families, and he asked me to be the person that interviewed the families to try to find out who these people were and what had brought them together in Guantanamo Bay. And I found, of course, complete confusion. Nobody in the families knew anything about why their son or their brother had ended up in Guantanamo Bay. Even the lawyers didn't know anything. But in the course of that, I got to know some of the families, and I was most particularly curious about one family that did not want to cooperate in the play, which was a Palestinian woman with five children living alone and apparently not speaking very much English. I wrote to her about the play and told her how ashamed I felt of my country from the research that I'd done. And to cut a long story short, we became close friends. And through her and her children, I met other women who were not necessarily with husbands in Guantanamo, but husbands who in different ways had got caught up in the war on terror. Some of them were in prison without trial in my country. Some of them were in house arrest in my country. And over this 10 years, it's been an incredibly enriching and extraordinary experience and a very sobering experience about injustice. And I never set out to write a book. I was much too busy doing people's homework and escorting people to hearings or to prisons or whatever. It never occurred to me because they're all women with a tremendous sense of privacy. They're mostly Arabs, and both their religion and their culture is one of kind of reticence and dignity. And it was only after some years that some of them began to say, you know, you're a writer. How come you write about other people and you never write about us? That I decided actually to write a play using their words. And when I'd done that, they were so pleased. They said, well, write a book. So that's how the book came about.
Well, you've given us a glimpse into their lives. Let's talk a little bit more about Saba.
Saba is chapter one and my close friend who I hold completely responsible for everything that was opened to me through this book.
Tell us what it was like. You go over to her home, and she's wearing a hijab, and her children are playing on the floor, and it's a very stark living room. Paint the picture for what it was like that first time you went and met her and how your friendship evolved.
Well, the first time, I think we were both very shy, but because she was living such an isolated life, because at that point, you know, everybody was so afraid of what it meant to be designated a terrorist and taken to Guantanamo Bay, that she had very, very few visitors. And it was kind of fun to have an outsider. And I'd recently been in Palestine, so I had a lot of stories to tell her. She was telling me stories about her family. And the kids began to play with me, a little bit wary, but we had fun. And at the end, she said, you know, will you come again? And I certainly did want to come again. And it was quite a long time, actually, before we ever broached the subject of Guantanamo Bay and her husband and her confusion. Because I think she was so busy. For 3 years, she never had a letter from him. And I think she was suppressing the agony of loneliness and fear that she was in, because she was so desperate to keep her children having something that approached a normal life. So she was always telling them, you know, Baba, he has a problem with his passport. He'll come soon. Don't worry about it. So that was something we never discussed. And it was only when other people began to come back to Britain from Guantanamo that we began to get a picture of the conditions in which people were, that she began to feel, you know, so horrified and frightened about how her husband, who was quite fragile in his health even before this, you know, how he was, that then she began to want to find out more, to go to public meetings. She never spoke in public meetings, but sometimes she would write a letter to our Prime Minister and have me read it for her in public meetings. But I can't emphasize enough the sense of confusion. Her husband had gone off to West Africa with three or four other men to try and start a peanut business. This was his idea. As a refugee Palestinian in Britain, he wanted to find a way of making a life for his family. And when she heard that he was taken from West Africa to Afghanistan and then to Guantanamo, she was completely, there was no explanation.
He was there on an innocent business trip. And the next thing, you know, he ends up in Guantanamo as a prisoner suspected of terrorism. She really couldn't get any answers on why this happened, could she?
No, she certainly didn't get any help from the British government. Her lawyers didn't know anything. The Red Cross, she was always ringing them up and asking if they'd seen him, and they always said they could give no information. Did they have letters from him? No, they didn't. So she was, you know, there was absolutely no recourse for her for a long time. And then, you know, as I said, information began to come out in dribs and drabs. And lawyers in Britain began to pressurize the British government to put pressure on the Americans to get these people back. But it took a court case, in fact, more than one court case, to pressure the British into actually asking for people who were not British citizens but were British residents.
And that's because a lot of these people were swept up, who were innocent of anything and who were stuck there, and there was no information that would come out about them, and there was nothing to do to help them get out of there. And the tragedy is that they're still there. It's been over a decade and they're still there. I wanted to ask you, Victoria, I know that her husband was eventually able to get back, but many, many who have been adjudged totally innocent are still there, and they're on hunger strike, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, what is so completely astonishing about this situation is that of the 166 men who are in Guantanamo, 86 of them have been cleared for release. Cleared in the case of some of them, including the one man from Britain, Shaka Armour, he's been cleared twice. He was cleared by the Bush administration, then he was cleared by President Obama's special task force of very senior former military and former intelligence people, completely cleared as innocent. And yet he's still there. and 11 years have passed, and there is no prospect of how they are supposed to get out, because your Congress has passed laws which make it almost impossible for anybody to be released. And the president, the most powerful man in the world, has not said, this is outrageous. I cannot be holding innocent men in my prisons. And it's that, I think, which makes people feel so sad about how the Obama administration, which first of all, he started by saying he was going to close Guantanamo. Here we are, all these years down the road. These innocent people are still there. And in the last 3 months, people have become so desperate because Congress is blocking them getting out. Every legal case that has been taken for habeas corpus or for trials in America, after the Supreme Court in 2004 said there should be federal trials for everybody, again and again, every legal victory done by CCR and other lawyers has been overturned by an appeal to a higher court. So for these men, they really feel they're at the end of the road. And for the wives and families, the mood, it's very hard to keep up a mood of some hopefulness, because there are these great big roadblocks, and nobody in America seems to want to do anything about it. I think it was great that last week you had 161 vigils for the men on hunger strike, but those were modest, and maybe the New York Times had an editorial saying Guantanamo should be closed. It had an excellent, excellent piece written by one of the Yemeni prisoners describing the real horror of being force-fed and losing weight to come to such a situation of weakness. And then the worst bit about being kept alive with tubes put up your nose very, very painfully so that you won't die and embarrass the government even further. The horror of this has been so well laid out by so many lawyers, and indeed now by the men themselves. I find it astounding that there isn't an uproar in Congress.
So you would suggest that those within listening distance of this radio show write their congressman and protest and ask that those men who have been adjudged innocent be returned home.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think they should write to their congressman saying, why don't you go on hunger strike and see what it's like? Publicize what is going wrong in our country. Take a public stand so that people know that religious leaders, congressmen, people who have influence in your society can say, this is morally absolutely wrong. This is not America.
We're speaking with Victoria Britton, who wrote the really beautiful book. She's more than a reporter or a commentator. She's really a poet, and her ability to capture these women. It's called Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. Victoria, let's talk about one of the women that was here in America, whose father, Sami Alarian, got caught up in the so-called War on Terror and is now in prison. You made friends with the daughter, Lila, and I wanted to ask you about her and what happened to her father and what they're trying to do for him.
Well, I just want to say that, thank goodness, Sami Alarian is no longer in prison, but he's under house arrest. I didn't know you had house arrest in Britain, but you do. And this professor from Florida is under house arrest. The long story of how he was at one point a crucial person in lobbying for, ironically, for the election of George Bush against Al Gore on one issue. Muslims at that time were extremely exercised about the use of secret evidence, which was putting people in prison, including Sami Alarian's brother-in-law. And Sami and so many other Muslim leaders and other faith leaders really, really tried to get the Democrats to take a stand against secret evidence. And Al Gore didn't do it, but George Bush did do it. And Florida went, as we all know, in that election to George Bush. And if there was one person who was mostly responsible for that, it was Professor Alarian. However, at the same time as he had been working alongside the Bush campaign, the FBI had been wiretapping him and his family for years. And finally, they charged him with material support for terrorists, which is the catch-all that people in this country get charged with.
And what did that mean, material support for terrorists? And in what sense did he support terrorism?
When the Democrats were doing so badly, he decided, and many others with him, that they would push, and actually successfully get the Bush campaign to say that secret evidence would not be used. But at the same time, I mean, he's an incredibly active person, and he had been an outspoken campaigner for Palestinian rights. And I think this had made him, in certain circles in this country, extremely, extremely unpopular.
Well, the media went after him, and I think people at the university where he taught was.
Yeah, it did. It went after him terribly. But, you know, this was a man who arrived in the United States age 17 to study. And he's a man who went from one degree to another. I remember Leila telling me this was somebody who really believed in the American dream. He really did. And he wanted all his children to be very kind of good, strong Americans, but at the same time to keep their Muslim identity and to speak out about injustice in Palestine. It's impossible to encapsulate in a minute what happened to Sammy.
Well, talk to us about, he was eventually incarcerated, and then what happened to his children, particularly Leila?
All his children went on to get their degrees. Leila is a journalist. All this, I mean, they had like 5 years in which the America they knew became something completely different. Most of their friends turned away from them. People didn't call them. And they had been real pillars in their society, real pillars, done things like building a school. His children and his wife were actually asked to remove the children from that school, which he and his wife had been responsible for. It was just completely extraordinary. And he spent, I think it was 5 years, in about a dozen different maximum security prisons. And 2.5 years before his trial were in solitary confinement. So the relations with their father for the children and his wife were either by phone calls or through plexiglass. And we know a lot about this family and what they went through because a very wonderful Norwegian journalist made a film, a kind of fly-on-the-wall film, of the time running up to the trial. And so you see the children coping with this reality. You see his wife going on these visits. And you see that his lawyers almost pulling their hair out. They just could not believe that this trial went in the way that it did. It was, in my book, there's a footnote to that film, and you can actually get it on the internet. And it's the most extraordinary wake-up call as to how injustice against a Muslim family, how it can be in America. There's a website called Free Sami Al-Aryan, and on that there is the whole litany of the cases, the various cases, and also a link to this film and a link to many of the speeches given by Leila and other children.
What was so extraordinary about the trial was that the defense didn't even put on any witnesses. Over this long trial where the government put on how many, 70 witnesses?
The thing was, they didn't put any witnesses because they didn't cross-examine. They took the 70 witnesses that the government had put up. Their only defense was the U.S. Constitution.
That is that whatever Sami Al-Aryan did, he had a right to free speech, and he wasn't aiding terrorism at all. He was speaking his mind. Is that correct?
Speech was the issue. Speech was the issue. In the end, although he was found not guilty, the prosecutors went after him again. And in the end, he agreed a plea bargain on a tiny affair of helping fill in an immigration form for a visiting British scholar. And he agreed to be deported to Egypt. So, after months of organizing this plea bargain, suddenly, part of the plea bargain was he wouldn't be called to be a witness in another trial. They broke the deal. He was called to be a witness, which he refused to do. And at that point, they placed him under house arrest. So it's his story is, in a way, if you look at the lawlessness of what has happened to the American judicial system in Guantanamo Bay and so many other aspects, I think the El Arian story tells it so clearly, but so astonishingly, that when people hear about it, they can hardly believe it's true.
It's not only true on this side of the Atlantic, but on your side as well. And I wanted to ask you about some of the women living in London whose husbands were snatched up and disappeared into either Guantanamo in Cuba or into various prisons in England.
Yeah, I'd like to tell you about the British angle, because, of course, the British and American intelligence services worked so closely together, and all the British men who ended up in Guantanamo Bay, including Sabah's husband, Jamil, it was the British who gave information on them to the Americans in this great big fishing net for information that they had at the time after 9/11, when they were desperate to make connections between all sorts of people to try to find out the source of what had happened. All kinds of completely innocent people got scooped up, men like Jamil and so many others. But there was a particular thing that happened to a dozen Arab refugees in Britain who'd been living in Britain for some time. And they were suddenly put in prison in Britain without any trial or even any interrogation. That was what was so amazing. They were said to be possibly associated with Al-Qaeda. And many of them didn't even know what Al-Qaeda was. They certainly didn't know each other. They were certainly not any kind of conspirators together. But they spent 2.5 years without being interrogated and without being tried in that British prison until the highest British court of the time, which is our House of Lords, ruled that it was illegal for them to be held there. They had to be released. So the Labour government at the time instituted something called control orders, which was a kind of house arrest. It was extremely draconian. People had to wear an electronic tag, of course, but they had a list of people they were not allowed to contact, even by phone. They were not allowed anything like mobile phones, computers, memory sticks. So for children doing homework, it was a disaster. But worst of all, they were put in this terrible isolation that only people who'd been cleared by the Home Office, individually and personally, were allowed to visit them. And in that atmosphere of fear among the Muslim community at that time, which I know was the same in your country as in mine, not many people wanted to be cleared. And so the whole family ended up in a position of tremendous isolation. And the other thing that made it particularly painful was that these men, being refugees, they had often come from countries where they had been tortured and they'd been in prison. Countries like Egypt, Jordan, Libya, Algeria. And many of the old memories and old traumas that they'd suffered resurfaced, and they became extremely, extremely disturbed. And there were some very high-level psychiatrists that did reports on them, which stated very clearly what serious state of psychosis many of them were in. Several tried to commit suicide on more than one occasion. Several ended up in a secure mental hospital. I mean, these were people being broken by the uncertainty and the complete injustice of what had suddenly come down like a bombshell on them.
And these were people whose wives and children were left fairly clueless about what was going on to their husbands. Yet their incredible resilience and the sacrifices they made are just extraordinarily stunning story that you write. Victoria, I want to thank you because we're running out of time, but I want to remind our listeners that you've just had published a very, very good book called Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. And I would urge you, all of you listening to me, to go out and get Victoria's book. You'll see what the cost of this war on terror has inflicted on all of us on both sides of the Atlantic. Victoria, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.